This is Darcy Ungaro, and welcome to the NZ Everyday Investor Podcast. Whether it's in property, Bitcoin, shares, or business, this is a show designed to equip the everyday Kiwi make better investment decisions. The NZ Everyday Investor Podcast is brought to you by podcasts.nz in conjunction with Ungaro & Co. Financial Services. Please remember, none of this is financial advice. We hope you enjoy the show. Hey, it's your host, Darcy Ungaro. How are you doing today? So today I'm really excited to have in the studio Jeremy Couchman, economist at Kiwi Bank. Now, today we're going to be talking about this thing called populism. What is populism? Some of you might know this. Some of you might not know this. I know I had to Google it just to make sure I had a correct definition of this. But populism, it's a political approach that strives to appeal to ordinary people who feel that their concerns are disregarded by established elite groups, including government. So populism exists not just on the left, it exists not just on the right, but it's manifested differently. Get the vibe of the general group of people who feel like they've not been listened to and feed that fear and ride that wave into power. That seems to be the strategy with some leaders in the world currently today. And we will not mention who they are, but we all know who we're talking about. So who is the enemy that you fear? Is it somebody who's coming from overseas and coming in to take away your jobs, to make housing more unaffordable, to change the culture at your local school? Maybe it's technology. Do we fear technology, and will we support a leader who seeks to restrict the use of technology so that your job is protected? Is it trade? Because if we have free trade with that country over there, it will make the cost of the goods that we're producing here too low and therefore uneconomical to maintain our current standard of living. You name it. On the left and on the right, there's plenty of issues to get upset about. And I guess that's one of the things that we need to be very cognizant of. There's a trend right now for populist leaders to take charge, to get into positions of power. That increases worldwide risk. And for the NZ Everyday Investor who's trying to build wealth, we need to understand that. We need to understand how populism might give an immediate shot in the arm, but ultimately there's significant risk. So we hope you enjoy the show, and thank you again for Jeremy and for Kiwi Bank for allowing us to have Jeremy for this time. Without further ado, let's get stuck into it. Okay, so welcome to the NZ Everyday Investor. I'm your host, Darcy Ungaro, and I'm in the studio today with Jeremy Couchman from Kiwi Bank.
Yeah, hi there. How are you going, Darcy?
Very good. Thanks for joining us today.
No problem. I enjoy being here. It's great.
Excellent. So today we've got kind of two broad topics, I guess, that we're going to cover.
Yeah.
We're kind of just launching straight into this, and we'll be looking initially at this thing called populism.
Mm-hmm.
And then second to that, we'll be talking about this wonderful thing called CGT, depending on where you sit on the spectrum. It's wonderful or it's terrifying. Either way, let's just talk about it. Maybe bust some myths in the process and get a bit of context, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the important part, the context behind it. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So just for the listeners, what are you into, Jeremy? What kind of music are you listening to at the moment?
I am a big fan of, I'd say, indie sort of rock type music, also a bit of hip hop as well.
Is that right?
Yeah, as an economist, I've gotten into that, surprisingly. So I think it's because of things like YouTube, where you start listening to music and then there's sort of recommendations or suggestions, and you start listening to other things and you start figuring, oh, that's actually quite I like that.
Yeah.
So what are some of the bands that I've been listening to?
Streets of Laredo, are you into them?
No.
They're kind of like a really good indie rock band, I guess you'd call them. They're actually Kiwis.
Yeah, yeah.
But they've made it big in the United States.
Yep, yep. Yeah. Oh, cool. I'll have to. I think I have heard of them.
Yeah, Streets of Laredo. There's two brothers in there, but they were in that other band, LMNOP.
Oh, yep. Oh, yeah.
So you
absolutely. Yeah.
So that's good. And in terms of other stuff that you're into at the moment, what's your favorite podcast that you're listening to at the moment?
Favorite podcast? I have...
The NZ Everyday Investor is the answer.
That's the first one.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, that goes without saying, right? I thought you meant by that, what's the second...
That's right. It's just a test.
Yeah. So if you go to RNZ Radio New Zealand, they have this show on Saturdays called the Podcast Hour. And I've just been listening to that, and it just tax podcasts from around the world.
Wow.
And so, okay. Yeah, you listen to just all, they come across all sorts of different topics, some really fascinating stuff.
Right.
And I found things on, like Freakonomics is a big podcast.
Yeah, I'm a big listener of that at the moment.
Yeah, that's very good.
Great, yeah.
And then some of the big media organizations have done some fantastic stuff. So the New York Times did one a couple of years ago called The Caliphate. So this is all about the rise of ISIS and that.
Oh, wow.
And that was a beautifully mastered podcast if you're into that sort of stuff, but also it had a really strong message about what actually goes on behind the scenes and how wrong the ideology is and how it's trapped or it recruits Western, say Muslims, with which are in a way brainwashed, I guess, or sold false promises and then are brought in and then it's hard to listen at times, but it's very powerful and I think it's it's a really good podcast.
And the Freakonomics one that you mentioned, I've been listening to that a lot lately.
Yeah, yeah.
It's such a well-produced show.
So from
where I sit, I'm thinking, wow, these guys are amazing to be able to edit something like that. But the content is really quite clever, and his interviewing style is very, I love his curious interviewing style. He's not a journalist necessarily.
No.
He's more like, he's just trying to find out answers.
Yep.
I think that's quite a cool one.
And it's not just about economics. When people hear that term and think, oh, it'll just be boring. But it's just a whole lot of stuff that they ask questions about. And I guess one of the things about economics is that he's using that kind of frame of mind to answer questions. But it's not just using economic theory or anything, but it's just, it's really well done. The one thing I have to say, though, some of the listeners, they have the background music on the whole time. They've got to kill it. This is so, it's good to have introduction. Yeah, anyway, but the constant music in the.
And what about New Zealand shows? Have you been listening to any New Zealand-based podcasts that you're into at the moment?
I have to admit I haven't, to be honest. Okay. I have...
because there's one that I'm listening to at the moment, which I'm finding really quite personally quite helpful and quite good, and it's the Happy Saver. And there's a lady by the name of Ruth Henderson, and she's been doing this for, I think she's been doing it for 2 or 3 years now. She's a personal finance blogger, but she effectively interviews people and then she just tells their story. Mm-hmm. And these are just New Zealanders from all over the country and they talk about their journey and getting out of debt and paying down their mortgage and building up some investments. And I find that quite good. It's quite grassroots. So definitely check that one out. But and what else are you into? Like on the weekend, what do you get up to?
Oh, I've been getting into a bit of running and swimming. Okay. So trying to just improve the fitness. Certainly something I may have sort of let slide. Having young kids, you sort of, your priorities change. But then after a while, you think, oh, I should probably get back at.
That's right.
So I've been pushing myself there.
Yeah, good on you.
Not fast, but I very much enjoy getting out there and
good on you.
Getting the blood flow around and
whatever. Move things around again. Make sure everything's still working. The next part of your life.
Some of it's not.
Everyone goes through that where when you pop out kids, it's like everything stops.
Yeah,
it's just an absolute mess for about 5 to 10 years.
Yep.
And then once that's over, you get back into normal life and you start, bringing in the income again, paying down debt again. And, your life gets a little bit better because you've got more free time to do stuff and exercise again.
Get rid of that dad bod that you've developed.
I'm still working on building up my dad rather than rip it down. Got more time to go. Okay, so let's get stuck into this. Maybe to start with, for our listeners, can you help me define what populism means? What does that term populism mean, or to be a populist leader, what kind of leader would you be?
Populism as a leader, I guess what you're talking about there is a politician who's sort of tapping into certain broad feelings of almost resentment. It's a negative, I guess, way of politics where you've had in a lot of Western democracies parts of, through a number of channels, things like globalization, things like technology change, things like the global financial crisis. These developments have led to parts of society, like large parts of the workforce, example, feeling a lot of resentment that they're not getting ahead.
Right, not being represented or,
or
left out.
Left out, but also they may have had aspirations that they want to own a house or start a business or have that boat or yacht or whatever and go have a nice lifestyle, but they've worked hard and they felt that they missed out and that they can't achieve it as well. That's been taken away from them. So there's, rightly or wrongly, there's that underlying feeling of resentment, and these populist politicians have seen this and have tapped into that negative aspect to in order to sort of enhance themselves or lift themselves up, and actually, you know, get involved in power and making decisions. And, I think it's a cheap way of doing that rather than addressing the issue itself. Yeah,
because it's kind of like, I guess it's scratching the itch of the everyday person and riding that, mm-hmm. which is usually a fear-based itch.
Absolutely.
Or anxiety or concern or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it might give a short-term boost to their popularity and they may be able to get in power, but ultimately it's a short-term fix.
And can lead to some crazy decisions as well. And so you got your political spectrum left and right, and it's not solely on one side. It's actually crosses both.
Yeah.
Extreme ends.
Yeah. So that's kind of, because you kind of think, well, I initially thought before I started Googling this last night,
mm-hmm.
I kind of thought, well, you know, Donald Trump, yeah, I get that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that's kind of like looking at the example of a populist leader on the right.
Right, that's right.
But then I looked at other examples of populist leaders in the past, and there's definitely some on the left as well.
Mm-hmm.
The enemies change. The common enemies may change. Maybe it's immigration and mm-hmm. it's
trade,
wealthy elite.
The wealthy elite, that's right, yep.
Or on the other side, maybe it's either people coming in to steal our jobs.
That's right, yep.
Or it's those people over there who are getting all the wealth. What about me, right?
Absolutely, that's a good grouping of it. So in the States, you have a mixture. So you have the right and the left. So on the right, you have Donald Trump, who campaigned as he became president on a populist agenda. So very much anti-immigrant, Mexican immigrants in particular, Muslim minorities, but also anti-trade and advertising the issue that the USA was not getting a fair deal with trade, with its major trading partners. And it really tapped into what they call the hollowed out middle in the US.
Right.
So it's people, I guess, your typical blue-collared workers who over probably 20 or 30 years have seen a lot of their jobs disappear or haven't been able to move up in terms of career progress. They've seen their communities in a way disintegrate, which is a sad story. And so, yeah, it tapped into those concerns that they had.
Right.
And then in the US, you've got on the left, you've got Bernie Sanders, who's a Vermont senator, I believe.
Right.
And he's campaigning for the next presidency. And he's on the other side where it's looking at the inequality in the US and the difference between the haves and the have-nots.
Right.
And if you cross over to into Europe, it's quite different as well.
Mm.
You've got in the UK, you've had Brexit. And that was a tap into, I guess, a conservative element over there.
Mm.
Again, this was around partly globalization in terms of the European Union or the UK coming into the European Union. But it meant that a lot of people from Europe came over and took jobs of, again, the sort of the blue-collared type worker.
It's a common theme, isn't it? It's immigration and it's trade.
Yeah, but interestingly, in Europe, it's not necessarily about trade. Trade has been is not necessarily the demon. And, and part of the reason behind Brexit is the Conservatives actually want the UK to go out on its own and get its own trade deals. They want to open up to the world. And they think that they're getting an unfair deal because of the European Union. And the European Union, it's pretty open about trade, but it's very much targeting these populists are targeting immigrants or Muslims or minorities, stoking up fear. And that's believed because there's established welfare systems over there, which that you don't have such a big welfare state in the US. So there are these cushions for people who may fall through the cracks.
Right.
But there's a fear that these people, immigrants coming in, are going to basically poach that and take that.
Gotcha.
It's interesting. I mean, it all comes down to, I think, the same outcome, which is, exploiting unrest, creating divisions, creating, you know, disruptions to the economy, etc.
And the populist leader mm-hmm. who rides that wave into power, I'm guessing, you know, their mentality is either, well, we'll use this to get into power,
mm-hmm.
or maybe there's a bigger agenda where they actually want to create division. Would you suggest that? I don't really understand that.
Yeah, I mean, I think so long as it keeps them in power, they'd be happy to create division. You know,
doesn't matter.
No,
as long as they can get into power and they can get their agenda across.
Yeah, maintain their ability to stay there. Yeah.
So it's very much tapping into those fears, mm-hmm. riding that wave into power, getting your agenda across the line. But the agenda that they have, whilst they might appear to be in parallel to that of the common person, it's not really exactly the same. Because really, they want to get into power and they want to make some decisions, they want to do some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But they're masquerading as, hey, we're gonna build a wall. And we're going to get a better deal.
We're going to put up barriers, that's right. We're going to get a better deal. And a lot of these things, they sound, there's almost a common sense element to them. You know, you build a wall and you're going to stop Mexican illegal immigrants coming through.
Yeah.
But in actual fact, when you look at the detail, there's no evidence to suggest that it's going to have a material impact on the number of illegal immigrants coming into the US. Apparently, a lot of them come through normal channels, so they'll arrive as tourists or whatever on a temporary visa through, you know, an airport, and then they overstay. A wall's not going to change that.
No.
There's a common sense element that I think a lot of people can tap into. Yeah, it makes sense if there's a wall there, it's going to solve the problem. But
yeah. There's nothing new under the sun. Because when I was looking into this, there was a Californian governor in the, I think it was the late 1800s. I wish I could remember his name. But it was the same sort of thing. He was tapping in to the fear and the anxiety that the common person had against the Chinese that were coming in at that time. This is the late 1800s. Mm-hmm. And so, and there was a cartoon that I saw, you know, saying keep the Chinese people out and all that sort of stuff. And I'm just thinking, there's nothing new under the sun.
No, that actually happened in New Zealand as well, that resentment towards the Chinese in that
that's
period.
Right. Yeah, in Canada too. But it's interesting because there is nothing new under the sun. It just keeps on coming up over and over again. And we keep on buying it to some level.
Yep.
Some of us will buy into it, right or left.
Yep.
And I guess there's risks with being, you know, being sucked into that, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, you know, we talked about, you know, America, Europe, I guess Italy's another story.
Yep.
Argentina, Venezuela.
Yeah, a lot of South American countries have seen the rise of populist politicians, and that's had disastrous consequences. I mean, I was here, 6 months ago talking about Venezuela.
Correct.
And the, is it Chauvinism? Hugo Chavez, when he came in, he rode a wave of populism there. And eventually it's come unstuck. That style of socialism has come unstuck, and it's a very, very sad story over there, as we talked about.
Refresh my memory, but that was basically, let's give the people what they want.
Yeah.
And write a check that we can't really cash.
Yeah, long term. So effectively, so there was a lot of inequality there, and there were a lot of social programs put in place by Hugo Chavez, which were popular and started working, but they were very costly. And as long as the oil revenue was coming in, they could afford it, but it didn't stay like that forever. You know, like any commodity, prices go up and down, and oil was no exception. Yeah, now here we are.
They're
very sad situation.
That's right. But this is a trend that's happening around the world, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
There's populist leaders rising up everywhere.
Yeah.
On the right and the left. And in their wake, there'll be potentially a trail of destruction, correct?
Potentially,
At a certain stage. Because it might work on the short term, gives people what they want, but what people want isn't always what they need.
Or get. Yeah, absolutely. And there are a lot of factors here at play. Globalization is one that gets jumped on, and there are some issues, certainly has been. So this is talking about the post-World War II period, and where everyone was, you know, in my lifetime, in your lifetime, this is the paradigm where we were sort of taught that you should open up your borders, you should allow trade and capital to flow. And what really wasn't talked about were the costs of that. And now we're starting to see those costs come through, and people aren't happy. And I think justifiably so. So again, you have seen, one of the big things we've seen is a shift, or we've seen, for example, labor's share of income in developed economies, that's essentially either hasn't gone anywhere, it started to fall. In fact, it's actually pulled back, particularly from, say, the 1980s. Mm. And replacing that has been the share of capital, income, the share has gone to capital has increased.
Right.
And generally, the people that hold capital are the very wealthy.
The wealthy, that's right.
And therefore, they are getting a larger and larger share. And so we've seen this rise in inequality. And
So it's more about the return on the equity rather than the return on your labor.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so wage growth might be very low and stagnant for a long time, but then you see these big multinationals, you know, tech companies which make billions of dollars, and they don't pay, and I agree, they don't pay their fair share of tax.
Yeah.
And that creates resentment.
Yeah.
And that gives that oxygen, I guess, to the populists. So there are some issues with it, and they need to be addressed, and you know, I would not say populism is the answer, but it's...
But policy could be.
Policy, yeah.
So I'm thinking of the truck drivers in the US and soon to be truck drivers all over the world, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got the rise of self-driving autonomous vehicles now. There's this probably, I guess, rising resentment between people who derive an income from their labor mm-hmm. and those that derive an income from their capital that they have deployed specifically via technology mm-hmm. in Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. And now they're the enemy. And so how would that look if there was some sort of populist uprising against tech?
Yeah. You know? I mean, you could see things like an exaggerated response around tax. So, you know, tax is potentially one way to even the playing field up a bit around this.
Yeah.
But you don't want to go too far and stifle investment. So that's the risk. It's interesting with populism, a lot of what's been jumped on by, say, Donald Trump is that globalization, where in actual fact technology is also in terms of the churn in the labor market, technology has been a big driver, but it's not really jumped on so much. I think general idea technology is a good thing, and it does. It certainly improves our lives, our standard of living, our incomes, but that income improvement is not necessarily shared as evenly as perhaps it could be.
Yeah,
and that's where you get the concern. So technology is certainly one of those factors.
And you look at Airbnb,
yes.
Uber,
yep.
What Google and Amazon are doing.
Mm-hmm. So they've really disrupted the advertising market, for example.
Yeah.
So they're sucking up all that advertising revenue, making a lot of money. Yeah. But where they say that money is, or the profit is being located, is not necessarily where the activity is happening, and therefore they're not necessarily paying. You know,
because the border is really blurry. Where does that actual activity go on? Where does that? What's the jurisdiction that's generating the income? Therefore, how do you tax it?
That's
the core issue.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. And I think there's certainly more needs to be done. I know the Labor, the current government is looking at adding a digital services tax.
That's right. Yeah.
But this needs to be coordinated among.
It needs to be a global thing.
Yeah, right? Otherwise it's not going to.
No.
You're still going to get that shifting of profits around the place.
Yeah. Yeah, because it seems like the target, and I use that term really loosely, but that the target to say, hey, these are those that have, and we need to take a little bit more of what those who have mm-hmm. and redistribute it to those who need.
Mm-hmm.
The target of that almost feels like it needs to go way further up. Because there's a lot fewer people at the very, very pinnacle
mm-hmm.
who are really disrupting and displacing a lot of the jobs that the middle are really suffering the most.
That's right.
Advertising, financial services.
Yep. There probably isn't many industries that haven't been sort of disrupted a little bit. I mean, banking is another one, an industry that I'm in.
Yeah.
And that's likely to be a lot more of that disruption in the years ahead. So.
Correct. Open banking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it's going to be interesting when the tech companies get in on that bandwagon more.
And yep.
So what do we do? Do we just keep on taking from, I guess, the middle to support those who are losing at the bottom, when in reality it's the middle that's actually probably suffering the most anyway from these changes?
Yeah, potentially suffering, yeah.
Meanwhile, the very pinnacle up here are still kind of untouchable at this stage. It's kind of what it feels like.
Yeah, and that is a big part of that resentment that's coming through. Mm. So that's it's becoming more recognized, this issue, certainly. And also it sort of taps into things around technological change that we need to really start thinking about, and that's around, how do we prepare our workforce for change like that, like the disruption to just the general workforce. So there's that hollowed out middle, like in the US or the lower skilled end. How do we lift those skills to areas where they can contribute into the future? And that's going to be a big part of the solution as well.
Correct. If they want to be lifted though as well. It's really hard to teach an old dog new tricks as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's what I'm thinking. But
yeah, and there's also the people that are less privileged that may not have the opportunities to be able to,
correct,
you know, improve their skills to that level.
Correct.
So yeah, you do need
still social support to take care of those who genuinely can't do it.
Yeah.
But then there's going to be this huge group of people that have just been honestly displaced, and they might be at an age where it's difficult for their heads to get around the fact they need to retrain and redeploy in something that they're not really experienced in.
Yeah.
That's going to be hard for a lot of people.
Yeah. And there are things that are discussed around the world. One of those is the universal basic income, the UBI, often talked about.
That's right.
That might be a solution. But I think, this change is not going to happen. We're not going to wake up one year and all of a sudden all these jobs have gone. It will be, I think, a slower process, and it's already happening. But also what we don't know, which you sort of don't know until after the fact, is what other jobs and what other things are going to be created from technology, because it is also enabling as well. Technology is not just about replacing, but it enables new jobs. I mean, if you think about 50 years ago, the types of, well, there's so many jobs out there now that never would have existed. But the jobs that are likely to be created are not going to be of, you know, you're going to have creative people, people with skills and talent, you know, willingness to learn, that sort of stuff.
That's the cool thing about Joseph Schumpeter.
Ah, yep.
Did you ever try to get into his work?
No, I didn't, but there's a column in the Economist magazine called Schumpeter, I think it is, and it's named after him.
Yeah. Creative destruction.
Yeah, right.
Like, so there's the creative and there's destruction. We're probably quite fixated on the destruction right now, but on the other side of that is this creative force, which does displace and does destruct, but what is there about that creative force? You know, could you be part of that?
That's right.
And I'm just thinking of people who maybe earn a little bit of extra revenue being an Uber driver right now. Yeah, it's really quite unfortunate with the taxi drivers, of course, right? But then there's some other people that weren't earning an income before and now they are. So it's sad, but it's also quite good.
Yeah,
not all bad, is it?
No, it's not. And
Airbnb as well.
And also the benefit to these new types of services is an improved customer experience, potentially. I don't know about...
customer first.
Yeah, customer
first. That's a real thing, yeah.
Providing what people actually want, that's more convenient.
Rather than being sold to something that, you know, it's actually something that people genuinely want and that they're driving it, yeah.
Yeah, and it's not stymied too much by regulation. And the other thing is, giving, I guess, workers or self-employed people a bit more choice and options in terms of generating income. Yeah, that's certainly that shared economy type thing or gig economy. Yeah,
that's right. So probably a more efficient use of capital.
That's right.
Because it's being deployed and used more rather than sitting idle.
So someone's personal car not just sitting there most of the day while they're at the office, but actually being used at times.
Yeah. So if you kind of roll that out on a macro level and you look at all these assets or all this capital that's out there and it's not actually productive, but then you overlay this technology, all of a sudden we're getting a better return for the capital. But again, it's for those who own the capital.
So there's an example of a productivity increase. It's about getting more out of what we've got, or you know, it's getting less resource-intense economic growth. So we've already got the cars out there. Some of those are electric. Hopefully more will be.
You see me driving today?
No, I didn't. Do you have a Tesla, do you?
No, a little Leaf.
Oh, okay.
Love my little Leaf.
Oh, fantastic.
Way to go, everybody. If anybody's ever in the market for getting a new vehicle this year, get a Leaf. Yeah, you don't need to have much more than 15 grand, and you can get a hatchback, which you can fit two kids in quite comfortably and on the weekend.
I've heard they're hard to get hold of. They're quite popular.
They're so popular, they're getting harder. But they're out there. They're still coming in. But if we all kind of did that, you know, if you could afford to spend that amount on a wee little hatchback, your repair bills, your running costs, your headaches, they all just go away. And you have this smug feeling of just driving around and nobody can smell anything behind you except your farts. That's the best way to be.
The one issue I have, so where I live, we don't have off-street parking. We don't have a garage, so charging it would be a little bit difficult.
That's right.
But
unless you did it at work.
Yeah, exactly.
Come on, Kiwi Bank, you got to install chargers in the office car park.
We don't really have, there's a tiny office car park, but that's for the top gotcha. Level managers.
Right. That's for the chief economist.
No, he doesn't even have one, actually.
He doesn't. Anyway, though.
Yeah, there'll be a solution to that problem, I think, at some point.
Yeah, that's cool. So in terms of where New Zealand sits in this space of populism, and you know, we'll try to be kind of fairly neutral on this topic here, but I'm just thinking of the ban on overseas buyers last year, the riding that wave of resentment for those who have more than one property. Could you say that maybe the current government has rode a bit of a populist wave where they've tapped into that?
I mean, my view is we certainly haven't seen in New Zealand levels of a populist politics that we've seen offshore. There's tiny elements there, but by and large, we have the two major political parties. They form governments where we get a little bit of share of the voice from the smaller parties. But broadly speaking, there's not massive difference between the two big parties.
Quite pretty much in the centre, right?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of perhaps tapping into that resentment, as you've mentioned, but also it's about looking at the one of our big issues in New Zealand at the moment, which is housing, and saying, well, hang on, what's been happening previously that may have been contributing to that issue, and what can, I guess, government do to try and alleviate that? So they've looked at a number of different things.
Yeah.
And one of those is, foreign ownership of property. And I don't think it's overly different to what we see overseas. I'm not entirely against it, given the pressures that we currently face in housing. And then the other thing is, I guess there has been a bit of a push against the property investors.
Yeah.
So you've things seen like the tightening of the bright line test.
That's right.
Which is effectively capital gains tax.
Yeah.
You've seen the closing of the negative gearing tax loophole, which I think should have never have come in place in the start with. That's a shocker.
Yeah.
So that's I think, a good thing. But you've also seen, what other things? There's been a bit of tightening in credit.
Correct. Increase in capital reserve requirements for the bank. Increase in...
That's sort of coming. But
Right. That's coming. But also just the whole responsible lending code.
Yeah,
it's common sense stuff, but the distribution of credit to people who need it to grow their households or grow their business has been tightened already. So I guess a lot of those things, we haven't really seen what the impact of that will be yet, because those are fairly recent changes. I was talking to somebody this morning, actually, who it was just interesting to know that he wasn't firstly aware of the capital gain, the bright line test. I always call it the capital gains tax for some reason.
Effectively, it is. Yeah. But
but he wasn't aware that it was 5 years, and a lot of people still aren't. Even people that are aware of it don't realize that it was changed to 5 years.
From about two, I think it was.
Yeah, from two. Yeah, yeah. Last year, that was one of the first things that Labour did.
Yep.
And a lot of these things, the ring fencing of tax losses. A lot of these things people don't really realize yet that how that will affect them. And then on a macro level, I think we all don't really realize what kind of effect that will have on house prices, rents, whether it's easier for first home buyers to get in or harder, or we haven't really seen that, have we?
So
it's kind of a hard thing to regulate when you haven't seen the effect of the measures that have already been taken.
Yeah, and these sort of things will, after these changes, will take time to actually, you'll start to see impact come through. But what we've seen for a while now, so I guess you'd say the national house price appreciation peaked a few years ago and started to pull down. And what we've seen since then, we've seen tighter restrictions on lending to investors. We've seen, those changes, as you mentioned. And in the market, there has been a shift towards new lending and from banks going more towards first home buyers, so that's a larger share of that. So we're already starting to see that, where that opportunity, I guess, is a bit more opportunity for first home buyers if they've got the deposit, their adequate deposit, whether
the income,
they can find a house that they can afford, because that's also an issue. So we start to see that, and I think these changes will probably swing that a bit further.
Yeah.
So you'll see more properties, probably that were previously rentals, come onto the owner-occupier market, so perhaps first home buyers or people moving from a different property. So you probably see more of that happening from these changes as I guess the investment properties don't necessarily look as attractive as they once did.
So thank you again, Jeremy Couchman and KiwiBank, for coming on the show today. Hope you enjoyed that. That was a really interesting and informative look from an economist's perspective, but also just two people trying to figure it out and think out loud. So we hope you enjoy that, and don't forget to tune in next week. Next week, we're going to be unpackaging the property market and the implications of the proposed capital gains tax. That will be very interesting, I promise. Thanks for listening in. You've been listening to the NZ Everyday Investor, brought to you by podcasts.nz in conjunction with Ungaro & Co. Financial Services. I've been your host, Darcy Ungaro. Please remember to subscribe to the show, and if you'd like to learn more about what we've covered today or any of our guests, please visit us on Facebook. The NZ Everyday Investor contains information and content designed to get you to think about your investment decisions, but none of this is financial advice. Thanks for listening in, and we'll catch you next time around.